Back here on Downtown 434. Rich Kimball, Bruce Pratt here for another edition of Sports Lit 101 and some sports poetry this week, Bruce.
Yeah. And a quick note to people, look in the New York Times yesterday, the day before, about the article on Grady Sizemore. It's one of the most interesting articles. To get back into baseball, it took someone who loved him when he was a player, and he only played till he was 32 because he had so many terrible injuries. And the guy really worshipped him, and Sizemore helped him, and more he helped him, the more he wanted to coach.
Huh.
And nobody at the Diamondbacks could give him a job, but he said, I'll work for $15 an hour as an intern.
Wow.
And he did, and now he's in with the White Sox at a much higher level of coaching. It's a great story.
Well, I didn't see that. To check it out.
Well, I brought it, so I'll leave you a copy of it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, so sports poetry. What happened was I was finally able to dig into That Beauty in the Trees by our friend Ron Smith from Richmond, Virginia, which is his collection of newest collection of poems from LSU Press. And we always have great poems from Ron that have to do with sports, but the majority of those majority of what he writes are not sports poems. He's a very, very good poet, and this book of poetry covers a lot of stuff. He writes a lot of poems about Italy and Rome and the like. And they would be, a lot of them are very literary kind of poems. The two that he's going to read today are just fabulous. But I thought what I would do before we get to Ron, because we don't want to spoil Ron by this afterwards, is the other day I saw a post from a former Black Bear, someone who had been in my class. And I've never had, I've only had two athletes ever with an unexcused absence in all. I've been teaching it up there since 05, right? One guy who could have had a million excuses for not coming, never missed one. And I thought we'd give him a little shout out. The poem's called Perennial. My son and my friend Larry will never forgive Art Modell for moving the Cleveland Browns to Baltimore. But I tell them if they knew Pat Ricard, Project Pat as his coach calls him, they'd root for the Ravens. When Pat was recovering from minor surgery on both knees his freshman year, he propelled his 6'1", 300 pounds of muscle all around campus in a non-motorized wheelchair. One morning, Pat was late to class, which had never happened before. I began to shut the door when a maintenance worker stopped me and said, Professor Pratt? Yes, I said. He said, there's a big guy down on the first floor who needs the elevator. We'll have it fixed in a few minutes, but he wanted you to know he would be late today. I left the door open. A few minutes later, Pat wheeled into the room to his classmates' applause. Four Pro Bowls later, he's perennial, not Project Pat.
I love it. That's great.
And it's a true story. I mean, he was so concerned that he would be late for class. He's in a wheelchair, right? And the elevator is not working, and they were able to get it working. He really came wheeling in about 5 minutes late, and everybody in the class started to applaud. So before we hear Ron's poems, I just thought I would drop that one into the mix.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
And Ron recorded these yesterday and sent them along to us.
All right. Let's give a listen to the first one from Ron Smith.
Estadio Guillermo Moncada, Santiago de Cuba. The brisk, beautiful women in military green would rather be somewhere else. Right now, this is the only place I'll ever want to be. Box seat, left field line, a day blazing and humid, marble galleons sailing the blue, serene stone armada floating above the stadium, camphor and tobacco, rum and sweat, sweetening the breeze. The hometown boys are the bees, avispas, Santiago hosting Havana, Mets who visit this time warp honoring a local hero who took his mother's name because the father he loved had been a slave. Writer, carpenter, brigadier general, black as electrical tape on a baseball bat, he attacked the sugar mill in La Guerra Chiquita and became a major general. I jumbled it all down in a tiny pad in a jolting ride from a bar hazy with historians and fabulous. The bewitching militia has its eyes on us, two Americans, three Slovaks, and an old Cuban who looks more like a farmer than a sports fan. He's following the play-by-play on a battered Motorola in his lap. Or is he, with that earpiece, a government spy? Josh grumbles again he'd rather see a bullfight. Those alluring, impassive eyes, what are they looking for? You can feel them pass over you like a searchlight. Bright red half-smiles, the bees behind them warming up in red and smudged white, the Mets solid red, gleaming combat boots they could use to check their eyeliner, unlike the players' dusty cleats, old, even cracked. There's only one first base glove for both teams, handed off when the innings change. I see no sidearms. Each crisp uniform has a gunmetal patch over a swellingly patriotic heart. Ministerio de Interior. And we are dreaming of interiors. Two Americans, three Slovaks, and a Cuban who's not too old to dream, you can tell, by the star in his milky sapphire eye. The Bees pitcher is having a day. Sliders, change-ups thump into the catcher's mitt. Then the leather screams at a fastball I didn't even see. This one's dark eyes drift over us, cools my damp shirt with its pocket full of cigars. She rises and moves toward me, extends her palm for the foul ball I one-handed like a kid. I pass the scuffed cowhide to her, meekly, without a word, awareness and patience in those dark eyes, like the eyes of her countryman who wrapped his knuckles on my passport, pretending to stamp it. She looks at me a long moment. The tall boy waiting at the wall is the third baseman. I realize I am holding my breath. She blinks as if nodding, then whirls and pops his glove with a laser throw.
Yeah, that is great.
Ron just amazes me. He'll be here in June. In fact, he's already got his reservations and everything set. And I'm hoping he's coming in early enough that maybe he can come by the show or one of the days during the Sport Literature Conference. He'll be there.
Excellent.
He'll be here.
And boy, this next one, when I heard this yesterday, I played it twice. It was so good and so powerful. So what's the title of this one, Bruce?
I Always Thought I'd Die.
Oh.
And this is, this is on page five. And I was just locked in the minute I read this one. It's really special.
Here you go. More of Ron Smith.
I always thought I'd die in a nuclear wink, would not have time to know what hit me. Or, after distant flashes and the shock waves, slowly of radiation sickness, combs full of hair, bleeding from the eyes, fingernails, nostrils, anus. After the president's head detonated, I walked the mile home from history class, dusty concrete along Augusta Road, scanning the sky for the first needle glints of Russian missiles. But it was only Oswald, a mere 10 years older than I was, I know now, son of one Robert E. Lee, a Marine like my father, like Lee O. himself, but dead before the boy was born. Young Oswald thought God was a dog, a star rats. His smiling chin-strap mug looks a lot like my teammates, Wells and Strobo, who both joined the Corps right after high school, got themselves killed in short order. Oswald was in radar, a word he couldn't get wrong. Like my father, he qualified sharpshooter. Like my father, he was honorably discharged. Unlike my father, he didn't deserve it. He never killed anybody until he did Kennedy and Tippit. He never boxed. He never looked like Clark Gable. My father believed somebody on the grassy knoll did it, even though he knew about the trip to Moscow. He slashed his left wrist. He met a girl with a Shakespearean handle, fathered a kid he named after a summer month, came home a family man, purchased an Italian rifle created within a few miles of the Shroud of Turin. Unlike my father, who sweated in thick savanna air, hugging creosote poles, Lee found it hard to hold a job. I have looked out that window. Despite what you have heard, it was an easy shot. My father killed several men on what he always called the island. It wasn't easy with an M1903, certainly not with a bayonet. Never had second thoughts about Hiroshima. They boarded a stinking troop train for San Diego, waited all day in the Carolina heat, were ordered back to barracks. No A-bomb, no Ronnie Smith, he said. A million Marines, soldiers, sailors, flyboys, a million would have bought the farm on the mainland. He figured his number was up. But boom, boom, the war was over. He took his malaria to Chatham County, married an operator with the middle name Lee, and sired, as they say, me. And though my Uncle Don, skinny and jumpy as Lee Harvey himself, rolled hundreds of warheads from Travis Field to Hunter Air Force Base about the time I turned 12, by convoy right through the heart of my hometown, down what is now MLK Boulevard. Looks like I'll make 70 years and 10. Haven't been vaporized or particularly irradiated, far as I know. One wide out of Vietnam, despite football. It wasn't the concussions or the trick shoulders, knees, arthritic feet, hips, spine. Blood pressure off the chart, the doc growled. No Hiroshimas in my lifetime. Not yet.
Man, oh man.
This is really an incredible poem.
And you know, like great songwriters, other people can interpret, but nobody does it better than hearing Ron do that in his voice.
Yeah, that's exactly why I didn't want to read these. Yeah. Why I wanted to have him record them, because I know how to read. I read all the time, but he has it, and you always get the feeling. I always get the feeling. Ever read one of Ron's poems, that it's a work of labor, that he's worked on it and worked on it and worked on it and worked on it, and that this book is really extraordinary. I mean, it is how many long pages long is this? It's 100 pages long, yet I think there are only 43 poems. There's a lot of them are longer ones like that, but they never bog down. Yeah. They always keep moving from one place to the next. And he's a pretty well-regarded scholar. But you know what I also like about Ron? Ron didn't spend his career at a university. He taught at the Christopher Wren School, a boys' school in Richmond.
Oh.
He and his wife have been there forever. He said to me, he says, you know, he's taught college poetry. He said, but something about teaching high school, Bruce, it makes you really understand why you're doing what you do. You and I both know that,
too.
That's
the truth,
so,
yeah.
I love my job at the University of Maine, but I love teaching high school when I was at BAPS, too, because if you can get kids interested in things. And we're just talking with Sean, the earlier people get interested in something, the more the opportunities are for them out there. And I can't imagine how great it would have been to have Ron be your English teacher.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that was wonderful. Next week, we're going to talk about the book Front Office Fantasies with the author joining us.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this because I tried my best to sort of break that book down. But I think Brandon will be much better at doing that. And the other thing I want to add people to do, if you get the Portland Press Herald or you subscribe online, I'd love to have you read my opinion piece today on routes in high school sports. And hey, send me an email right through the University of Maine English Department. Let me know what you think.
There you go. Bruce with Sports Lit 101 here on Downtown. We're about 13 away from the top of the hour. We'll take a break back in just